Next up, a case of life imitating art. A few months ago, we talked to writer Barbara Kingsolver about her latest book, Flight Behavior. The book is a fictional account of an ecological disaster in the making, and the fate of millions of monarch butterflies is at the center of the plot. Would the species survive? That's the art part. Now comes the life imitating part. My next guest says that monarchs in real life are in serious trouble. The latest census from the butterflies overwintering spot in Mexico shows a population plunge this year. Habitat destruction, among other factors, is to blame. So how will this story end? Joining me now to talk about it is my guest. Lincoln Brower is a professor emeritus of zoology at the University of Florida and a professor of biology at Sweetbriar College in Sweetbriar, Virginia. Thanks for talking to us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a wonderful opportunity.
You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman. Tell us, give us a sort of status report on the butterflies this year.
Well, we have a record that goes back for 20 years, and we've known their colonies in Mexico since 1976. And this past year, the colony size hit 2.94 acres. And that was, the highest year was 52 acres. So there's an enormous difference between the highs and the lows, and we're way below average. And the problem is over the last decade, we've just been going down, down, down. And this year it hit such a low number that we're worried about their recovery and what it means in the future.
And the number of acres corresponds, I guess, to the number of butterflies, right?
Well, the way we measure the butterflies and the way we were able to get at the actual numbers, when you're looking at a colony, there are so many butterflies you can't possibly count them. But there was a storm in 2010, and butterflies were dead on the ground up to 3 feet deep. And we were able to estimate that there are 50 million butterflies per hectare, which is about 20 million per acre. So if we had 3 acres, that would be about 60 million butterflies left this year. And that's getting down to being a perilously low number, because in the big year with 52 acres, that year there were more than a billion butterflies overwintering in Mexico.
Mm.
More than a billion butterflies.
A billion with a B.
With a B.
That is, it's shocking.
Well, there's another decline this year that was very shocking, too. We had, in previous years, we had 17 sites with colonies. This year, 8 of those sites had 0 butterflies. So, and the rest of them had very few butterflies. It was only one colony that had a significant number. And not, my worry is that they're winking out one by one, and they may not be able to recover.
So they're not making it to these overwintering grounds.
That's the numbers. Would you like me to discuss why we think they're going down?
I would. We only have about a minute left now, but let's start with one of the reasons anyway.
Well, one of the main reasons why the colonies have gone down over time is the degradation of the OML forest. This is where the beautiful forest high up in the mountains protects the butterflies like an umbrella and a blanket, keeps them from freezing. Even though they're in the tropics, they're at such high elevation that they're subject to winter storms, rain, sleet, snow, freezing. And in 2010 was the big kill. And if you thin the forest, it's like cutting holes in a blanket or chopping holes in an umbrella. Rain gets in, the butterflies get wet, and then when it freezes in the early morning, they die from frost.
Dr. Brower, let's start with some basic biology of what the butterflies are actually doing down in Mexico. What's their life cycle like?
Okay, well, I need to get to the herbicide-tolerant soybeans and corn crops at some point.
We will get there.
Okay, well, what is so amazing is that in the fall, starting around the 21st of September, these million up to probably 2 billion butterflies migrate out of their breeding range in the Great Lakes states and the whole eastern United States. And they migrate down through Texas, and they arrive in Mexico almost to the day on the 1st of November. And then they cluster in these beautiful fir trees that are sort of like the Christmas trees that we have. And it's called the OML Fir Forest. And they become very, very tightly aggregated in these colonies, and they spend the entire winter there. And then when the 21st of March comes, which is exactly 6 months later, they leave Mexico and they fly north into Texas, breeding along the way. And when they get to Texas, they find milkweeds, and there they lay their eggs and establish the new spring generation. So these butterflies are now 7 or 8 months old, having been born in September, spent the entire time in Mexico, hibernating there, and then moving back into the breeding range in the spring. It's pretty amazing life. And then those offspring that are born in Texas take about 3 weeks to develop, and they migrate up north and getting all the way up into New England and into southern Ontario and establish the next generation. And then there's a couple of more generations. And then what is amazing is that the butterflies that are produced the following September are able to fly back to almost exactly the same trees in Mexico that they've never seen before.
That is amazing. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is why the generation times are different, right? Some live for 7 or 8 months, and the next generation lives for fewer?
Right. Well, there's this super generation that's produced in the fall, and it all relates back to the evolution of the monarch and its history going back probably a couple of million years. And that is, the monarchs are belong to a family of butterflies that are all tropical. But when milkweeds evolved in North America, and now there are 108 species, this was a huge evolutionary opportunity. And the monarchs migrated out of Mexico to take advantage of these milkweeds. But the monarchs are tropical butterflies, and so they have to migrate back to the tropics in order to survive. So that's why we have this complex migration. And if they were to breed in Mexico, they would lose their migratory urge. So they have to stay quiet for several months and then fly back into Texas, get back into the breeding mode, and establish the short-lived generations, which then breed over the summer.
It's like a relay, a baton being
handed.
It
is, exactly.
So why is the milkweed so important to them? What do they use it for?
Well, milkweed is the only plant that the whole family of butterflies can eat, and the monarch feeds on all these different species of milkweeds, and only a few of them are really common. And the problem is that milkweeds are being killed off by herbicides and genetically engineered soybean and corn crops on a huge scale.
Describe that more. How are they being killed off by the genetically modified crops?
Well, soybeans and corn have been genetically engineered to be resistant to high-powered herbicides, particularly glyphosate, which I think is also called Roundup. And when a milkweed plant is sprayed with that, it kills it. When the corn and soybeans are sprayed with it, they're perfectly happy. They've been selected to be resistant to the herbicide. So we know that 63% of the milkweeds in the Midwestern United States soybean and corn belt have been killed over the past decade. And I have been out there and seen these. I was looking at a soybean field, and I can only describe it like as standing on the foredeck of the Queen Mary looking out over the sea of soybeans, and there was not a single milkweed growing or any other plants growing in that entire field. So these herbicides are sterilizing the environment on a scale which is probably unprecedented in the history of humanity.
So it seems like there are a lot of economic incentives for this type of agriculture, and it would be hard to change the direction of that train overnight. But is there something that people like our listeners could do tomorrow to help the monarchs?
Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S Society, and Monarch Watch and other groups are developing milkweed gardens and encouraging people to plant them extensively throughout the range of the butterfly. It's a partial mitigation. Another mitigation that could be gotten into that I think would be very significant is to work with highway departments in all the different states so they don't spray the sides of the roads or cut them at the wrong time. And we know if you cut the milkweeds at the right time, it actually promotes the growth of the caterpillars.
That's a great idea. So all of our highways could be lined with milkweed.
and the midways too. I mean, it would not only be milkweeds, and another really important aspect of this glyphosate kill off is that it kills all the nectar plants. And so that all the insects and all the birds, the entire food web is affected by these kills. Whereas if we had wildflowers and milkweeds growing all over the roads along the United States, it would be a significant mitigation.
You can go to sciencefriday.com/milkweed to learn more about where to get seeds if you want to plant your own monarch garden. And they'll seek it out if you put it in your garden?
Oh, absolutely. Monarchs are absolutely magicians when it comes to finding milkweeds. In fact, one time we were making a movie with some people, and the milkweeds had barely come up, and everybody was very worried, couldn't find any. And I said, follow that female. And she just went from plant to plant to plant, and finally we found all the plants in the field. It was pretty impressive.
That's amazing. Let's go to the phones. Tom in Milwaukee, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, I'm just listening to your show, and I'm glad the subject came up. I grew up on the northwest side of Milwaukee in the late 50s and the early 60s, and there was a forest. It was pretty rural back in those days. There was a forest, and as children, we would go into this little forest, and we'd see thousands of monarchs. It was amazing. We were just in awe of what we saw. About 1963-64, homes were built in that same spot, and they tore the trees down. There are no longer farms there. There are no longer the monarchs there. And my statement is probably along their migration highway, some of the habitat along that way is also being destroyed too, which kind of helps with the endangerment of their species.
Thanks for calling, Tom.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do you have did you want to say something?
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, the problem is habitat destruction on a grand scale, and development is another problem, just taking what were natural fields and converting them into development. But I think the really serious problem that we have to confront, I think we have to work with the chemical companies to help us mitigate this business of killing off the entire food chain. It's just a very serious problem.
I want to mention another link. If you want to track your monarch sightings, go to sciencefriday.com/monarch map. And if you're interested in milkweed, sciencefriday.com/milkweed. Let's go back to the phones because a lot of people want to talk about this. Ashley in Indianapolis, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about how climate change, global warming, could possibly be playing a role in the disappearance of the butterflies.
Did you get that, Dr. Brower?
Yes. There's a lot of evidence that's coming out to indicate that that butterflies that occur in the mountains are moving higher where it's cooler and moving further north. With the monarch, we don't know what's going to happen. It's possible that the milkweeds will move north. The monarch is such a mobile creature, it may be able to follow them. I think the problem is in Mexico, if there are several studies that suggest that this beautiful Oyamel forest will be driven up above its capability of surviving. And so that may be a problem. But again, the monarchs are mobile, and they may be able to move if the forests move.
Is there any chance of monarchs relocating their overwintering sites somewhere north of Mexico?
This was a question that my colleague Dan Slayback at NASA had, and we flew over the area for about 2 weeks looking for colonies. In the whole area, we covered a huge area, and we did not find a single new site other than the ones that we already had known about. I was astounded. I had predicted there were lots of forests. They should be there, and they weren't. They were always going back to the same spots.
Do we have an idea of what's so great about those little areas, or what's different about them?
Well, probably they may very well be very old, and we have a hypothesis that the monarchs are in some way marking those spots with a chemical that persists through the season to the next fall, and when the new generation comes back, that somehow they sense that odor or chemical and that's why they're always coming back to the same places. And one of the supports of that hypothesis is that areas which have been terribly degraded by predatory logging, the monarchs have come back to them, even though they're super exposed and really vulnerable to freezing.
And that would explain why even the different generations that have never been there before can find the right spot.
Exactly. A lot of people don't agree with this, and we have very weak evidence in support of it, but I think it will prove to be the case as time goes on.
I'm talking with Lincoln Brower, a professor emeritus of zoology at the University of Florida and professor of biology at Sweetbriar College. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman. You've been studying these guys for over 50 years now. How do you not just get so depressed by this news?
Well, I think underneath it all, I am an optimist. And one of my really wonderful reasons to be on this program is to reach people, because we need a constituency. We're going to stand up for all wildlife. And the monarch is really popular with school teachers. Journey North has something like 40,000 participants. Monarch Watch has at least that many. And it's a wonderful educational tool. And it's such a beautiful thing for anybody to get to Mexico to see it. It's just overwhelming to see it. And to me, the monarch is a treasure, like a great piece of art, and that we really need to develop a cultural appreciation of wildlife that's equivalent to art and music and so forth.
Well, you see pictures of these overwintering sites, and it's spectacular, even just through the internet.
They are spectacular.
Let's go to Des Moines. Kay, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Thank you for mentioning Journey North. I've been watching, we've been following that for years. My kids and I have been harvesting the eggs and raising them inside and then releasing them. And I've often wondered and didn't have anyone to ask, are we helping? Are we hurting? We do the bleach water to protect from the OE, and we share it with the classrooms so more kids have a chance to watch them change and emerge from their chrysalis. Should we keep doing this, or is this damaging the population?
Thanks, Kay. What do you think about
my answer to that is that anything you can do to get children interested in the monarch, even if there's a slight cost, the benefit is going to way outweigh that cost, and those will be the people who are going to protect the butterfly on into the future.
What are the butterfly's natural predators?
Well, that was a lot of my early work was done on that with my wife, Linda Fink, and we found in Mexico that there are two major predators. And it's a really interesting story, because milkweeds are toxic plants, and the butterflies absorb and store the toxin in their bodies. And if a blue jay eats a monarch butterfly that's fed on a toxic milkweed, it'll throw up.
You took that famous picture of the blue jay throwing up.
That's Brower's barfing blue jay. Anyway, and what we found in Mexico was that there were two species of birds, an oriole and a grosbeak, which had broken through the chemical defense. And it turns out that the orioles were really clever. They were pecking into the butterfly and tasting it. And if it was poisonous, they dropped it, because it turns out that only about maybe 10% of the butterflies in Mexico are really toxic. And so they are, by taste discrimination, able to break through this chemical defense. And so that sort of gets you to another philosophical point, that no defense is ever perfect. Somebody's always going to break through it.
Yeah, I like that note. I wondered, too, I read a little bit about dragonflies. Are they predators? I read that they ate the faces off of butterflies. Is that true?
Well, so do praying mantises, but I think the overall mortality by dragonflies is probably not that large.
Go ahead.
Well, the big danger to monarchs is loss of habitat, and I think that all the other mortality factors are pretty minor.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about this, Dr. Brower.
Thank you, Flora, for asking wonderful questions.
have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Lincoln Brower is a professor emeritus of zoology at the University of Florida and a professor of biology at Sweetbriar College in Sweetbriar, Virginia. That's about all we have time for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kee Molesky. If you missed any part of this program or you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video, on iTunes and Android apps. Listen on our website at sciencefriday.com. Check out our video this week about the science of coffee. It's chock full of chemistry. Tweet us at SciFry. We're on Facebook, too. And if you want to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 19th West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York. You can email us, too, at SciFry at sciencefriday.com. The Big Enchilada will be back next week. You know who I mean. Ira Flatow. I'm Flora Lichtman in New York.